Welcome to the Film Experience. This is our latest SmackDown companion podcast. The year in question is 1948. So I have the whole panel with me. We have with us today a special guest, Abdi
Hello.
Nazemian.
I grew up watching old movies obsessively, starting at the age of 10. So I'm very excited to revisit 1948. Since then, I guess I've gone into the film industry. I've written a few movies and wrote my first book last year that came out, and that's it.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Will you be very uptight about casting if they option your book for a movie?
Well, since the writer tends to have no control in movie making, no. I will let go. I will completely let go and let them do what they want.
Okay, so and then we have Catherine Stebbins.
Hello. I run a blog called Cinema Enthusiast, and my sort of project that I've been doing for the past 2.5 years is the Top 10 by Year project, which takes, I sort of go deep into certain films that I haven't seen as much from and do a whole bunch of posts regarding that and taking a bunch of films and putting them in a specific context and like a specific point in time is really exciting to me. So the SmackDown panel is kind of like porn for me. I love it.
With that said, have you ever done 1948?
No, the only year of the 40s I had done was 1943.
Okay.
So, but when I get back around to the 40s, I might pick this year just because.
We have returning Joe Reed, who you know and
Yes, I was
love.
gonna say. All too familiar with me. You're, yeah.
But you also have, you said in the introduction post that you have no connection to 1948.
I am really almost shamefully deficient. Good Lord, that airplane outside is really loud. Sorry if that's picking up on this.
Actually, I think it's Tim who's racing around. That's the
It's I'm doing the
noise.
first ever edition of supporting actress SmackDown Born Supremacy special edition as I race home through the streets of King's Cross. I apologize, but I'm now off the noisy road, so that's
We've
good.
added a physical challenge component.
Yeah.
I wanted to kind of jump in out of my depth, and I sure was.
And Tim Roby.
I've just entered my building, so it's now much quieter. I normally do film reviews on the Daily Telegraph, and I've done supporting actress SmackDown since the beginning of time, I think. Since the very early Stinky Lulu days, I've loved doing them.
Now, in your function as the critic for the Telegraph, do they ever let you do old movies, or is it strictly contemporary?
Yeah, I can do old movies, and well, there's stuff that gets reissued, say by the BFI. So just the other week we did The Misfits.
Okay.
But I always love having a reason to kind of watch the stuff I've never seen. So this is one of my favorite things about supporting actressing.
Great. So, and you all know me, I'm Nathaniel. And I run the Film Experience and host these SmackDowns, which Stinky Lulu was kind enough to let me take over. And the reason, actually, I was working from a big long list of years when we scheduled the SmackDowns this summer, and the reason I chose this was a similar reason as why Joe chose this year is I had, and this is my shameful secret, I had never seen any of these movies.
I had seen Key Largo and Hamlet, but not for like 10 years, so.
Okay.
I had seen Key Largo. Yeah, otherwise they were all new to me.
Yeah.
And I've seen a lot of old movies, so that's saying something.
Yeah. Johnny Belinda, for example, was a big deal back in the day. So I don't know how I've never seen it, especially since I'm an Agnes Moorehead fan and I'm a Best Actress aficionado. I have no idea how I haven't seen it, but I hadn't.
Yeah, I was surprised to see that it had like 12 Oscar nominations and
Yes. Yeah.
that it was like the second highest nominated film like at that point. It just yeah, I had never like I had heard of it. I knew nothing about it though, so.
Yeah. Now, one thing that I thought we should probably start weak and get stronger. And I think from all of your write-ups, I think everybody liked I Remember Mama l least.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Oh, I was gonna say, can we forget Mama soon?
That's its new title in history. I forget Mama.
That's a lot of movie to forget. It was
Oh, God.
so long.
I know. It
I
was so
kept
long.
thinking the whole
Well,
time. The whole
Can I be honest, though? I muted through most of Oscar Homolka's performance. You have to mute that. It was so loud. My kids were asleep. I was like nervous he was going to wake them up and they would be afraid. Like, it was so loud.
Yeah, that like whole scene where he's trying to like get them to, he's trying to understand like why the kids are afraid of him. I'm just like, you are not. No, this is. You were so scary.
Tim, we're talking about muting Oscar's performance in I Remember Mama.
I would totally be in favor of that, having just been muted. I understand the impulse to do that, so yeah.
The whole time I was like, was this filmed in real time, these memories? Because it seemed like it took, like everything took so long, and like even, I sometimes love little business where they do the whole business, like making a cup of coffee or whatever. But in this movie, I was like, will you please, like I'm going to walk down the stairs and I'm going to follow them down the stairs and then down the street. Like, everything took so long.
So it's the opening chapters of Catherine's narration. We get to hear them more than once. And like, you know,
right.
This book really better hot up after the first page. Otherwise, I'm out of here. You know?
Yeah. And then and that especially doesn't work because the writing is so bland and it's supposed to be good writing.
Well, that's the thing, is she's supposed to be this like acclaimed author in the framing device or something, that this is, she's speaking from some sort of text that has had a bit of success, I believe, and you wouldn't be able to tell it by the parts that we hear.
It sounded more like a little kid's diary, like today I did this, today I did that. And
yeah,
this
today I remembered Mom. Tomorrow I probably will too. Yeah.
That George Stevens directed it. Now I don't know how you guys feel about George Stevens in general, but I tend to love his movies.
Same.
Well, he's the Ang Lee of the '50s, right? Two best director wins without best picture.
This was the first movie he made after the war, right? He went off to the war. And then he came back, and there is a sense that he's trying to, because the movies he made before the war, a lot of them were really fun.
Yeah.
I mean, he directed like Fred Astaire movies. And I think this was his attempt at making like a serious picture, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, if there was one theme for me from this Oscar year, it's how much they rewarded these like important issue movies and ignored so many wonderful movies that have stood the test of time. But you know, might have felt lighter in tone, but you know, to audiences today, we can still watch them without pressing the mute button.
Mm-hmm. So. either lighter in tone or like heavier in their kind of style. There's a lot of really kind of heavy stylized work this year, which I'm sure we'll come on to, like some really great noir, proper noirs, not like Key Largo noir, but really full on noir and stuff like Force of Evil. And those films were ignored, and it's the middle stuff, it's the kind of middle ground that got recognized, I think.
Yeah, the George Stevens things just throws me, because even when he did like family, like slightly corny family stuff before, it had a lot of weight to it, like Alice Adams, which is I think a really good movie. And then right after this, the very next movie is like a masterpiece, A Place in the Sun. So
maybe
he just needed to get this out of his system. Like, I don't know.
Well, Alice Adams is the film that this like dreams of being, basically. I think Alice Adams is like the model for this kind of filmmaking, actually, and he just failed in this instance. Although I do like Irene Dunne in it, I will say, and I think I agreed with what Joe said about how Ellen Corby was maybe the one element of the movie that kind of is up to Irene's level or in any way kind of competes with her for what you want to be watching.
Yeah. And Corby doesn't have the benefit of the rest of the movie building a groundswell towards her the way Irene Dunne's does. Although I guess that's totally pressure for Dunne's character, too, to live up to all of this.
Yeah, I would say that the degree of difficulty for Irene Dunne is pretty high, like whenever you're the obsessed over character.
Yeah.
But she is great, as always.
I guess I'll go on the record and say I did not like Irene Dunne.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I thought she was a little grating, and I found her accent really.
Well, I will say this as
for some reason.
I will say this as probably the only one of the panel who has lived in Norway. That the accents.
Fine,
were,
I'll give you that one.
That the accents were like. It was just odd because, like, every once in a while, I would hear someone be like, "Oh yeah, that sounds right." But it was just so didn't.
They were just even in her case, they were so strong and like if you look at another movie from that year, the Billy Wilder movie A Foreign Affair with Marlene Dietrich, where she plays a German and she actually is German.
Yeah.
Her English is so much more unaccented than these people in I Remember Mama, who are just they're laying it on so thick. It was just really hard for me to get into their characters. I felt like they were pummeling me over with their accents.
It's the Steel Magnolias problem, right? With like
Julia Roberts.
She's from the South, and then she's going to amp up her southernness to make sure she lets you know it.
Better or worse, do we think the accents in I Remember Mama versus Agnes Moorehead's in Donnie Belinda, which every time she pulled out one of those R's, I was knocked on my ass. It was so funny to me. I don't know. It was just random and odd. And I've never been to Nova Scotia, so maybe that's how everybody talks, but I kind of doubt it.
Well, that's not how everybody else in the movie talked.
Right. God bless her, too. She's always doing her own thing. But, like, wow.
But I think that's such an example of, like, for me, if you put Agnes Moorehead's performance in I Remember Mama, I think I would have really disliked it. But because she got to play most of her scenes with somebody who was mute, it was perfect. It was like the mute button was already pressed. And her performance kind of shined because of that.
Abdi, I love what you said about her counterpart brusqueness, because I think you need – I think sometimes with Jane Wyman's sort of like very like soft performance that you need something to work against it. Cause I think some of the scenes with the doctor are a little flat.
Yeah.
Mm. Just cause he's not as like dynamic a performer as Agnes Moorehead.
I'd go along with that. You know what? I think of all my write-ups, I was probably a bit harsher on Agnes than I might've been, but she's like one good scene in the second half of the movie away from like a three heart score, which I was toying with.
Uh-huh.
But I just think once after her great turnaround scene, which is easily her best scene, and that she gets loads of physical stuff to do in it that's really interesting.
Yeah.
That from then on, it's like Jean Negulesco doesn't really know what to do with her. She just keeps kind of hand-wringing and kind of just being vaguely there in the scenes. And right at the very end, the tiny moment she gets is almost an insult. It's like this kind of smiling kind of silence, sidle up to her at the end and give her a smile and all is well. It's like we've forgotten about her by then, basically. Mm-hmm. She's just so I just did think that the movie essentially abandoned her after doing that one great reversal.
Yeah, she definitely works best in contrast with everything else. For as much as sometimes we tend to prize acting and supporting categories that sort of supports that's a dumb way to put it that contributes to the overall vision of the film, where she so necessarily has to play against aspects of the film for our betterment as an audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I will say that, you know, when we're talking about like balancing it out with what movie she's in and the performer she's with, it's like the last time we had Agnes Moorehead on a SmackDown, it was for Hush Hush Sweet Charlotte. And I just thought she was so wildly over the top because she was playing against these really big performers, you know? And, like, I was like, maybe maybe you should go against that grain if, you know, since you're the supporting character. But here it was really welcome, you know?
She kind of brought dynamite to a knife fight with that one. But I did love that one, as you recall. But, yes. I know what you mean.
But I do I think one of the things I don't want to dwell on I Remember Mama, but one of the things that I liked that both Joe and Tim wrote about Ellen is that you would rather see a movie about her, and is that a mark of a good supporting performance or not? I always think that's a curious thing to think about, and I don't think I could handle a whole movie about Aggie.
No. No.
I don't really think I could handle a whole movie about Claire Trevor, but it's like when she's in that movie, it is her movie. In her scenes, it is her movie, basically, and only her movie.
Right, that's true. Yeah.
So you kind of get the benefit of that or the disadvantage of that, depending on where you're coming from.
Right.
Well, and like the converse of that is we get so much of Barbara Bel-Geddes. Like, she's in so much more of her movie than any of the other women here are in of their movie. And yet she's easily the least interesting.
Yeah.
In terms of characters, in terms of performance, I would say, of these five. I think the narration she does works for what the movie's going for, even though it's objectively not something that I enjoyed. But that's why I think I sort of bumped her up to that second heart. I was just like, what they asked you to do, I think they were, you know, I think you were doing it. But it was tough.
One of the things I love about this doing the Smackdowns is like hearing the different perspectives, which is why there's a panel. And I have to say, like, maybe my favorite thing anybody wrote this time was Catherine about Barbara Belgetti's. Because it really made me think about the performance differently. It didn't change my mind, but like your note about her partial cognizance that she's in gently reenacting memories.
Yeah.
Was super interesting to me. So I'm really glad you put that in there.
Yeah, thank you. No, like, and it's funny because now that, like, I read everyone else's, I'm like, I probably would have knocked that down to two parts. But, I think she has the advantage of having the most screen time, and I do think that she's not able to do much with it. But I also, what they are asking her to do, she is representative of the entire tone of the film, like all of the sentiment, all the gooiness. And even though she's not able to really rise out of that, she's just sort of supposed to represent it. I felt bad about, and she's playing it, you know, she's 26, she's playing like a child. There was a lot going on with her that I just sort of felt bad that she wasn't able to do anything with. And even though she doesn't have like the essence of like a Garland or like a Mickey Rooney, for me, she does have something that draws me to her. So that's what got me through. But other than that, like, it's really hard to separate sort of what the performance is and like not completely resenting her for being responsible for the entire movie in a sense. You're just like, oh my God, like, this is all your fault.
I felt like such a bully when I was watching this film because I got increasingly fed up with her. Anything antagonistic that any of the other characters did towards her, I'd be like, yeah, go, yeah, sister.
Throw that damn cat in a bag and take it away.
It's like, go for it. So I did turn on that character, I'm afraid. Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to hear anybody complain about Uncle Elizabeth, which was my favorite part of the movie.
The cat definitely should have been nominated.
The cat steals every scene.
Yeah, it has like a near death scene and everything.
And good.
Yeah, that would have been its clip if it had gotten.
No, I would have used clip that moment where the little girl blows in its face. I'm like, that is one patient cat that it didn't hiss at her.
I don't know though. I would argue that even the cat's accent was a little too strong.
Johnny Belinda and Key Largo, they were actually, you know, I just did a tiny bit of research on the year, but they were both big hits that year. And why do you think Key Largo only got the one nomination? Do you think it's because it's noir and they have problems with genre? Or because I thought it was very good, Key Largo. I hadn't seen it before.
I mean, issues of quality aside, I wonder if it was one of those things where, you know, John Huston had a horse in the race already with Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
I think so. I hadn't thought.
Although that said, if you look at some of the best noir movies, they were not very beloved by the Oscars.
Yeah, that's true.
It's not a genre that was widely, I think, praised when it came to awards.
Mm-hmm. And I also think
it's aged so well.
Yeah, you maybe also factor in the Academy's like notorious antipathy to Edward G. Robinson, who they never nominated. Mm-hmm. If they'd liked him at all, the nomination would have been, you know, logical. I think he's kind of going for it in that part. Whereas other actors in the ensemble, I think Laura Bacall is actually pretty badly miscast in there. So I don't know. It's a surprise to me that it was that big a hit, actually.
But Laura Bacall is, you know, her face. Who cares about miscasting? I could look at that face for so long.
I loved Lauren Bacall in it. God.
Oh,
I kept wanting her to have more to do. I feel like that was an odd choice for a character for her who did a lot of sort of sitting and looking with that gorgeous face, obviously, Nathaniel, as you say. Mm-hmm. But it seemed like a lot of her character was kind of just sort of like looking at her dad, looking at Bogart, looking at, you know, events sort of happening around her. And Claire Trevor's character gets some interesting things to play, and Bogart obviously does, and Edward G. Robinson. Nothing really against the movie, but it did feel like that's an 80 watt light bulb where you only need like a 40 or something like that.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. I think it's like watching Lauren Bacall play a kind of Eva Marie Saint sort of role, where she's just the, sort of sitting there waiting, and the husband died at war, and like who's going to step in? And there's something kind of quite skim milkish about that whole part. It's funny seeing her in it. It's because of Bogart, basically, is why she's there. Mm-hmm. Which is fine, like, you know, we'll happily watch them.
And also, just like the other Bogart Bacall movies, they're so at the center of it that it's kind of jarring. I had forgotten sort of how kind of off to the side the two of them are for a lot of it, as far as like their dynamic goes.
Yeah, it's very much an ensemble picture.
Yeah.
And it's also, what's that term for TV episodes that are all in the same place?
Bottle episode.
It's very much like a bottle episode movie.
Yeah.
So I wasn't surprised to hear that it was based on a play.
Yeah.
Actually, all four of the movies nominated in this category are based on plays.
Oh, yeah. So the stagey thing is interesting to me. I remembered liking Key Largo more. Going back to it, reminded me of the problems I have with Night of the Iguana. And it's like The Dead is a great example of a stagey John Huston movie that really works for me. Where he kind of brings out all these textures and it feels very alive. And with the other ones, I just found this, how static it was a problem.
I agree with you. Like for me, it sort of alternated between like the sort of embracing the staginess of it really worked, and then there are other times where it felt really inert, and it kind of was bouncing between the two for me.
Maybe because I hadn't seen it before, but I was just thrilled by it. I was so excited the whole time. And I thought more indie filmmakers should try these one set things, you know, because you can make them on the cheap.
Yes,
you can make a good contrast with Hamlet, I guess, if you're talking about, you know, adapting a play and trying to do something. I mean, there's moments in Hamlet which I think break out totally of a stagey vision, like when the camera's swooping around rooftops and plunging into Olivier's skull, which is a great way, in fact, to justify what he's doing. It's like, this is a very Hamlet-centric Hamlet, but they're inside his head, so that's why. It's like, I think he did some brilliant things there. And I don't see any touch like that in Key Largo, which kind of broke me out of the set, basically. But
what worked for me, what worked about Key Largo, ultimately, is that I really felt a relationship between all the characters. I think the actors and the director actually succeeded at creating an ensemble movie where you thought these people related to each other. And in many of the other movies, that's what I was really missing, was any sense of like real relationships and real rapport. I mean, that to me with Hamlet, like I did think it was a beautiful kind of cinematography, you know, beautiful set design, but I never really felt like the characters related to each other in any real way. Mm-hmm. They all felt like performances.
For me, Hamlet and Key Largo feel like they were made in different decades, almost like different centuries from each other. Like Key Largo seems so much more forward looking, and I guess it's the genre difference as well. But Key Largo feels like the kind of movie that things were maybe going towards, and Hamlet seems very kind of, particularly like in the performances, just so much stagier and kind of stiffer, and I don't know, it just felt like it was a little bit, you know, it's tough to say old-fashioned for a movie in 1948, how the hell would I know, but you know what I mean? Am I totally crazy?
No, I would actually say I completely disagree.
Oh yeah,
because I felt both of them of the four movies. I thought they were both the most modern.
Oh, okay.
Like I mean I'm not I realize that I have issues with Shakespeare that a lot of people don't have. I just feel like all of the plays are so familiar that it's hard to, like, you know, experience them in the way I think they're meant to be experienced, because you're always comparing them to, like, every other version of them. But it just felt very muscular. Like, I remember when Kenneth Branagh first burst out in the late 80s, early 90s, and he was doing these, like, Shakespeare movies, and everybody was talking about how, like, you know, masculine wasn't the word, but how vivid his filmmaking was. And I was just really surprised by this, because I thought it was going to be more dull and more stagey, and I really felt it felt like cinema to me.
I just felt like Olivier was really trying to throw a lot of stuff at the wall and see what sticks. And I think that for, you know, every sort of thing that he tries that didn't really work for me, about three or four things did. I
I
mean,
think he's
Hamlet's
trying to
my.
do, he's doing Orson Welles, right? So I can understand
Yeah,
the fact that
exactly.
he's basically doing Welles. So he's going back to the early 40s, but Welles was already 10, 20 years ahead of his time himself. So, like, I don't mind that. It's okay.
I really loved the way that the scenes would transition in this, which surprised me. Like, it got the feeling of, like, that, I forget who said this in the write-ups, but that none of them had ever left that castle. That's what, like, even though it didn't feel stagey to me because the camera was moving so much, I guess, but it did feel very, like, claustrophobic in terms of their points of view. And, like, the fact that, like, when one scene ended, you would just basically zoom down the hallway, and one scene would be looking into the next scene.
I like all that, and I was interested to hear what everyone was saying about how they felt that Olivier was kind of neglectful of Ophelia and Gene Simmons, because I thought it was even more the case with Gertrude. I kind of think Gertrude gets very lost in this ensemble. And I wonder, I mean, I understand the point about the relationship not really being there. It's totally it's like a Hamlet about Hamlet being separate from everyone. It's like that's the way. So I can understand that decision on his part. But I did think Gertrude really suffered, actually, and a lot of the other supporting players did too. But
Well, I
not for
think
me, Gene Simmons. Yeah. Anyway.
well, I think like as like I think of like the Get Thee to a Nunnery scene and how Olivier kind of he's sort of doing the scene around her and doesn't really give the scene the progression that I normally sort of look for with it, because he makes the decision to have Hamlet know that he's being spied on the entire time. So I feel like that's sort of where our focus is, instead of like is on him knowing, instead of sort of letting that progress. So I think there were just like that's just an example I can think of like certain ways where he, I don't know, where he was pulling focus to him like right off the bat instead of kind of making it more of a two-person moment between the two of them.
That's true. But then again, with the mad scene, he compresses the mad scene together with the suicide in a way that the play does not. You know, there's a whole act in between those two bits. So he's decided this is now the Ophelia bit, and she really—he's not even on screen during that entire section. And the camera belongs to her in that for that whole 15 minutes or something. It's about her, right? So I thought he gave her enough there, and that's her best part of the film, I think, as a performer too.
Yeah,
But
I would agree.
And I think that like Ophelia's death, like it's really important that it kind of looms and haunts over the rest of the sort of proceedings afterwards. And I feel like Gene Simmons does that. I feel like you feel it the rest of the time, like her absence.
I think for me, maybe one reason I didn't feel much in this version of Hamlet is the tone of it was so relentless. Like it started in one mood and it sustained it for the entire movie. You felt like you were in some like this heavy Freudian, you know, narcissistic dream of his. And there was no like, it didn't take you through any emotions, you know, that ebbed and flowed. And so I feel like at a certain point, I just felt anesthetized to it. So by the time you got to Ophelia's big scene, I was just like so glazed over by the whole thing. Whereas I feel like many other Hamlets, they have comedy in there. They have moments of levity that allow you to kind of break from the heaviness of the emotion. And he really cut all of that out.
Well,
And,
except
you know,
except for
I
that
appreciate
foppish
it. I
servant.
appreciate him.
He was trying a little bit with the foppish servant to throw in
I
a
mean,
little comedy.
It's Peter Cushing. It's
Is
Peter Cushing.
it?
Yeah, it
Yeah,
is.
Oh my god. How
Very early
funny.
Peter Cushing.
Abdi, I actually love what, like, I couldn't even I couldn't even process Gene Simmons without thinking of how much I wished it was Vivien Leigh after reading your...
Oh my god. I know. Well, I mean, the you know, Vivien Leigh, who's one of my favorite actresses, who I just think has the, you know, the exact brand of madness. Like, when you look at her, you know that there's something boiling underneath her. And, you know, to know that she played it on stage with Olivier just made me so upset. So I just went into it, like, resenting Gene Simmons. I'm like, damn you, Gene Simmons. But, you know, for me, it's just, it didn't have that. She didn't have that. And honestly, I mean, I said this in my write-up, and it was kind of a joke, but I really did spend so much of the time, like, analyzing some of the choices. Like, I did, why were they bleached blonde? It was so odd.
Yeah, that was strange for me.
I mean, both of them. Both of them had, like...
Denmark. They were going for the full...
Denmark by way of Transylvania, too.
Exactly. Exactly.
I feel like her first couple of scenes are pretty wobbly, and there's a lot of very actressy pausing at the beginning. I was worried, and that's the way I remembered the part, but she did grow into it for me this time. And I was kind of moved by her at the end, and then I was thinking back about the other Ophelias that we've seen on screen, and I think she probably takes it over some of the others for me, over Helena Bonham Carter and Kate Winslet, for sure.
Well,
I haven't seen the Alma Rader one for a while.
Well, I will say that the... that the, you know, Catherine, when you mentioned Helena Bonham Carter's dodgy-eyed interpretation,
yeah.
I was thinking that even though, like Abdi, I wanted it to be Vivien Leigh, I was also thinking maybe seeming mad in general, maybe it wouldn't work with that part, because maybe you have to see the fall into it.
I think that's right.
As opposed to always having that sort of edge to you. Because I did, but and the thing I really liked about her Ophelia is how floaty she was. I realize some of that is costuming and camera work, but she didn't seem corporeal to me. And then, so it seemed even sadder when she couldn't even walk properly when she was mad, you know. but this was the most divisive performance of the five, but also like. It was so divisive that even within myself that I agreed with like everything all of you wrote. from
such
the
a people pleaser.
Yeah, no, but you know what I'm saying? Like every negative thing I was like, yeah, that's totally true, and every positive thing I'm like, yep.
Yeah.
So I kept changing my mind about it, which is why I sort of cheated with the middle ground.
Also, I cannot be the only one who kind of wanted Barbara Bel Geddes to do the Olivier narration in Hamlet, and Olivier to do Barbara Bel Geddes narration in I Remember Mama. Imagine what different movies we'd have got.
Well, but also, we both, Joe, I think you and I both mentioned how Claire Trevor basically plays a version of Ophelia.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally.
And does it better. And I think that's something that's really interesting here, because you see the Shakespeare archetypes being played out in different ways, in different genres, and coming off as so much more vital and modern and relevant. So,
yeah,
I mean, I think that was a really...
I give you a little high-five on that when I read that. I was like, yes! Somebody
Yay, else. I did too! Well, we're high-fiving each other over Skype.
Yeah, I mean, I guess Trevor got her due. We don't... Probably don't need to discuss her that much, but I will admit that... I am not as familiar with her as I should be, because I realized she was an Oscar favorite. But did anybody have any strong relationship to her work before seeing this one?
Not particularly. I know I had seen her in a few things, but I don't... The fact that I can't really name them, I think, says a lot.
Yeah, I mean, IMDb, you know, they always... list a lot of things about the performer that you don't know if they're true or not, you know?
Yeah.
And one of the things was she was called the Queen of Noir, which I've never heard her called, but I'm thinking maybe...
Well, you know what? I can throw in one performance, which, I mean, I'm out on a limb as not loving her in Key Largo nearly as much as everyone else, but I do love her in another movie from 1948, which is Anthony Mann's Raw Deal. She is brilliant. She helps... the main character out of prison, and then for the rest of the movie is in a kind of three-way scenario with him and a younger woman, and she's kind of giving side-eye to this younger woman the entire time, and she's brilliant because it's a very hard-boiled movie. I think her presence in that film, to me, is much more electric, in fact, because it's not just handed to her on a plate. You're kind of like her to the side, and there's something really mean about her in it as well. And I think she slots into that sort of situation really well. I mean, I can understand why the Oscar went to her for the Key Largo performance, but my heart is with her in the...
Isn't that funny how that so often happens with Oscar, where somebody is just having a really good year when they win?
Like Dennis Hopkins, you know, not winning, but, you know, at least being nominated for the wrong movie. Blue Velvet year, you know, they kind of switch. They switch it up.
Yeah. It does seem to happen a lot with Oscar. I mean, part of that is how Hollywood operates, and when you're hot, and they cast you and everything, you know?
Yeah.
Since I'm not that familiar with 1948, I didn't... Usually, when we're doing the Smackdowns, I have a lot of people in mind that I would wish they had been nominated, which is not the case this time, because even the movies I love from 1948, like Red River and The Red Shoes... they're not really supporting actress movies, so I didn't really have anyone in mind that I thought should have been nominated. But other than Claire Trevor and Raw Deal, anyone have anyone else they loved from this year?
Well,
Go ahead.
I mean, I had mentioned it in my write up for Agnes Moorhead, but I really liked Jan Sterling in Johnny Belinda. I thought she had a pretty tough part. You know, she makes a lot of really horrible decisions throughout the movie, and is, you know, reacting out of emotions like jealousy and things like that. But she, even though she redeems herself at the end, she can't, you know, she has to play those moments. She plays those moments as if, like, you know, we know that she's not like a bad person. She's just, she's just making really poor choices. And I found myself more captivated by her.
I mean, I could be laughed off of this podcast for this, but I personally would have just given the Oscar to Ann Miller in Easter Parade.
Easter Parade, yes.
Oh, I always forget about Ann Miller in that. Yeah, because I was...
I mean, Ann Miller... I mean, that's one of those performances that I think if it was today, she would become a nominee. But, you know, back then, I think there... You know, it was a musical comedy.
Uh-huh.
She was just this, like, beautiful comedian, but she's really funny in it. She has one of the best musical numbers in
history,
where she just, I mean, the tap dance, she tap dances for like 10 minutes and the camera's just on her and she just never breaks. I mean, it's just, it's like a thing of beauty. And, you know, I don't know, to me, that's the kind of performance that back then just wasn't appreciated.
Well, because it was more commonplace back then. Now people would be like, wow, if they saw something like that in a movie.
That's true, but it just makes me sad that performers like that never really got their, you know, their chance to be appreciated in the industry in the same way.
I'm glad you mentioned her, because I love that movie, but I hadn't even really, because I'm such a Judy Garland fanatic that when she's in a movie, I tend to forget that other people are in it.
She was on my list, but there's one other person who's my big standout for this year, who's just like unbelievable, who I think should have been like the Monique of this supporting actress year. It's an actress called Hope Emerson. It's Cry of the City. You will watch this film and you will be like, this person. She gets about 20 minutes of screen time. She runs a massage parlor. She tries to strangle Richard Conte. She wants the diamonds that everyone has stolen. And this is a film with Shelley Winters in it as well, but Hope Emerson looks as though she could frankly sit on Shelley Winters and squash her. She is absolutely amazing in it. Great. I think she should have been straight in. They obviously realized how good she was, because 2 years later they did nominate her in Caged.
Oh,
but this is the one.
She's really good in Caged.
Yeah, the other thing that I thought was so interesting about 1948, it was the very first time both Doris Day and Marilyn Monroe made movies. And, you know, I find them both to be like such underappreciated actresses by, you know, Oscar. Not that they should have been nominated for these particular roles, but I just thought it was interesting as I was researching the year. They're two of my favorite,
and
like,
also,
screen presences.
Totally, and it's also Monte Cliff's first year, so it was a big, big debut year. Yeah, and Red River, like, where was its Oscar nominations? Is it the same problem that Noir had, where like westerns were so, you know, common?
Was Red River nominated for anything?
Editing and writing.
Well, maybe they thought that Treasure of the Sierra Madre was kind of enough of a Western to stand for the Westerns.
Yeah, because, like, I don't know how you do 48 without Red River. I just can't. But, you know, time time changes things. Oscar can't always be blamed.
You might be right about it, though, because I just looked up The Searchers, which is now considered, like, the Western, and it got no Academy Award nominations. Mm. Not one.
That was a controversial Western in its day, I think, as well. And it's the one that's now considered kind of a masterpiece, but I don't think it went down immediately that well.
Well, neither did the best Western ever made, Johnny Guitar.
Right?
Now that. Now that is a Western.
But Letter from an Unknown Woman is one of my favorite movies ever. And this much lesser seen Fritz Lang film called Secret Beyond the Door, which is very strange, kind of like a take on the Rebecca Gothic melodrama. Lots of weird, sort of surreal imagery, lots of pop psychology. It's a lot of fun and it's very strange and I love it.
Okay, so thank you all for joining us for the Smackdown. It was super fun to read all your comments. And so as we go, I want to thank everybody. I want you to propose a modern actress to take on one of these roles we just discussed. And the reason I ask this as your exit question is that one of our readers said that they wanted Melissa Leo to play the Agnes Moorehead role in Johnny Galinda. So thanks again. So Abdi, thank you.
Yep. Thank you. That's really fun. I would like I Remember Mama to be remade with a young Lindsay Lohan. How's that?
I think she would do the narration better. It would have
she
more.
She would have been lovely.
She'd need a lozenge or two like halfway through, but yeah.
And Catherine, thanks for joining us. Any remakes?
Yeah, probably for the like 78th version of Hamlet, I would love to have like a Keira Knightley Ophelia, but like from like 2005, like 2005 era Keira Knightley.
So you're a time machine and a remake.
Yeah, doing it all.
Joe Reed, thank you.
Thank you. I'll go with, I would like to see Patricia Clarkson take on the Claire Trevor role in Key Largo, the Ellen Corby role in I Remember Mama, and the Agnes Moorehead role in Johnny Belinda. All in the same year. It would be the greatest feat of actressing we'd ever seen.
And she would finally get her Oscar. I will co-sign. That's beautiful. And Tim Roby, thank you. You even did the physical challenge, our first physical challenge.
I did, and Joe's stolen my thunder, because I was going to say Julia Ormond for the Claire Trevor role. But what I can say instead is, you know, thank you, Nathaniel, and thanks everyone else. But most of all, first and foremost, I remember Mama. Most of all,
no. But first and foremost, I have forgotten her now. It's done.